Thank you for being here. And I realize that on a Sunday morning, there's a lot that you could be doing. You could be sleeping in, you could be catching up, you could be watching other things, and you've set aside this time. And I'm so glad that you did. I think sometimes it's good for us to look at that. Why do we meet? Why do we gather? I think this is one of the gifts of COVID, honestly, was that as everything shifted to online and church became a screen, you know, we were like, what really is church? What is this all about? What is the significance of the gathering? What am I hoping to get by coming to church? I remember a time when I was experiencing quite a bit of neck pain, and I went to a chiropractor, Gary Arthur, down the street. And he said, well, you know, Jeff, why are you here? And my answer was, I want to be out of pain. And he said, that's not good enough. Right? What do you hope is on the other side of being free of pain? What's the vision for that? Is it, I want to surf with my kids, or, you know, I want to have, like, play with my grandkids, or, you know, what are these things? As you think about vision, sometimes we just are so stuck in this kind of immediate, like, just get me out of this situation. And the challenge of vision is to think beyond that, to ask ourselves, what is life supposed to be like, not just with the avoidance of difficulty or complexity, but, like, what does flourishing look like? What does it mean to really be functioning as we were designed and meant to function? I came across a quote, and I don't have the slide for this, but a quote from Viktor Frankl where he says, what man actually needs is not a tensionless state, but rather the striving and struggling for some goal worthy of him. Viktor Frankl, who endured tremendous persecution, understands there's a deep meaning, a deeper longing than just comfort. I think so often our vision is for some sort of immediate comfort, some sort of resolution of the difficulties of life. And yet what we find is a God who's maybe not so preoccupied with our comfort. That tends to not be the first thing on God's mind. Then instead, God is offering a way of living that is bigger and deeper than maybe anything that might be our vision for ourselves. I think we're constantly having to shift our vision around God's vision to understand his purpose. Today in our lectionary readings, the psalm we have is Psalm 1. And this is going to seem familiar because I quote it a lot. I just so love this psalm. But Psalm 1 says this, how happy is the one who does not walk in the advice of the wicked, or stand in the pathway with sinners, or sit in the company of mockers. Instead, his delight is in the Lord's instruction, and he meditates on it day and night. He's like a tree planted beside flowing streams that bears its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. Whatever he does prospers. And this idea that what God is inviting us into is this life of flourishing, this life of abundance, this life bearing fruit, this life being nurtured by this stream and being brought more and more into our purpose. Whatever we do prospers. Now, it's important to take a stop right there and go, so what does that mean? I remember I had this coworker and she used to pray, Satan, take your hands off my Cadillac. And she didn't have a Cadillac, but she felt it was coming. It was like this, God wants me to be thriving, and clearly it's that car right there, right? And, you know, I do think God does care about our provision and what we have and that kind of thing. I think certainly he cares. But too often when we think of prospering, we think of this lens of some sort of worldly prosperity or maybe attractiveness or influence, popularity, being talented, being seen as competent, that's what it means to flourish. If I was just recognized for being talented and successful, then my value would be clear. Like, God, that's all I'm asking for. Let me be a successful, flourishing tree that is just attractive and popular. And the thing is, when we get those metrics wrong, When we borrow the wrong metrics, I think sometimes what we find is that thing that we envision as flourishing isn't really. If I just had a little bit more, right? We've talked about this before, that with money, that wherever you are on this sort of economic scale, wherever you fit, the amount of money that you think you need to be happy grows exponentially the richer you become. That if you ask somebody who has nothing, they're like, gosh, if I just had like $10,000. You ask somebody that's wealthy, what do you need? And they're going to say, if I just had $10 million. Right? That need grows. It's just this sort of weird reality that if you think of thriving as a sense of deep satisfaction and contentment, if we're using the wrong metrics of success, if our vision is for those things, what we find is we're digging a deeper and deeper well. And the kind of fruit that that tree is going to bear becomes the wrong kind of fruit. Hopefully, when you walk into this church, you find a sense of belonging. But most of the time when we walk into a group, we start doing this kind of comparative evaluation. Do you ever catch yourself doing this? Who am I in this space? Where do I sort of fit in this kind of natural pecking order that's here? Who am I in this space? And most of us, if we're honest, have a little bit of a shtick, something that we like to be seen as. And honestly, this goes all the way back into the way that we were raised. Who am I? I'm the responsible one, or the funny one, or the smart one. I'm the entertainer. I'm the servant. I'm the one who's safe. We create this identity for ourselves, and then we're constantly trying to fit in whatever circumstance we're in. I think of this time where I was at this think tank, and as the person was speaking, he all of a sudden in this group paid me a compliment. And there's Jeff sitting in the back row, which is part of my shtick, and mentioned something about me that all of a sudden I flushed and everybody turned like, that guy, right? And my friend next to me was like, teacher's pet. But I was like embarrassed and flattered, but also at the same time going, this is sort of my game. I want to be sort of the low-key smart guy. I want to sit in the back, but sort of all of a sudden have somebody stumble upon like, oh, wait, who's that guy? And when I think about it, I go, gosh, I've been doing this my whole life. It works for me, right? But if I'm honest, there's a reason why, as I trace my story back. I'll talk about this a little later, but times where I feel like those expectations have been so high that I've disappointed people, and how I manage that instead, trying to find my value in this sea of comparison. James, our passage for today, says, who among you is wise and understanding? By his good conduct, he should show that his works are done in the gentleness that comes from wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, don't boast and deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where there's envy and selfish ambition, there's disorder in every evil practice. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peace-loving, gentle, compliant, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without pretense. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who cultivate peace. This is what it means to thrive and flourish. James is describing this is the fruit. This is what shows the healthy tree. And he gives us this lovely little comparison here between below and above. And see, when we think of comparison, when I even think of above and below, I tend to think of myself comparing myself to those that are better than me and those that are worse than me. I'm constantly trying to figure out where I fit into that scale, or at least that's this tendency in myself. And I think in all of us, there's this exercise that they used to do with groups where they would say, I want you guys as a group to just arrange yourself in order of importance. Most important to least important. And it was this interesting sort of exercise. Where would you gravitate to? And what you find is most people know, well, I'm not going to go to the front of the line, but I'm going to try to be like in the top 20%, right? So you have this jockeying. And anyway, and it's this sort of indicator of something that just sort of happens naturally. I was reading Brené Brown. She talks about this idea of comparison, and she says, comparison is the crush of conformity from one side and competition from the other. It's trying to simultaneously fit in and stand out. To fit in and to stand out. Like, if I could just have both of those things, right? What I want is for nobody to see me, but for everybody to notice me. What I want is to just blend in, but kind of be special, right? And you're like, oh, these two things are actually kind of oil and water. I want to fit in, but win. And that thing, there's this ego inside of me that wants to be at the top. And then there's this other side of me that just hates to lose. Hates when people are seen as more successful than myself. And James is going to talk about, interestingly enough, these are both sides of the same spectrum, right? Rather than looking at the smart people above or the people that I feel better than below, he's going to turn this whole thing on his side and go, this is all below. And you've got this spectrum here. Here, maybe on the far side is selfish ambition, where I'm winning, crushing it, right? And over here is bitter envy. And in some ways, they're both the same sides of the same game. And when we're playing it, we're constantly wavering between those two, maybe at times experiencing both at the same time. And as long as we're playing that game, there's no flourishing. The fruit that comes up from us is this deeper resentment, being pulled further and further into my self-obsession. What we see is with the contrast, the wisdom from above, there's such freedom and self-forgetfulness in it. I read from Brené this definition of envy. She says, envy occurs when we want something that another person has. It's just that simple. You look over there and you're like, ooh, that's what I want. What is social media but like an envy-inducing machine, right? Of constantly looking at everything you don't have. Envy occurs when we want something that another person has. These two researchers wrote this. Envy typically involves two people and occurs when one lacks something enjoyed by another. The target of envy may be a person or a group of persons, but the focus is that one lacks something compared with a specific target, whether it be a target individual or a target group. I was thinking, okay, so I have a couple confessions in this sermon. You heard the first one about my shtick, trying to be the low-key smart guy. But this one, and I apologize this for Philly, because this has to do with a guy that you deeply like that I have a little bit of envy about, is this guy, John Mark Comer. He's like 10 years younger than me, and he kind of like beat me to the thing. Like his thing's kind of my thing. And he's like better at it. I even went to his church kind of hoping it wouldn't be that great. And it was awesome. And I was like, shoot. And so I was like, all right, I just need to humble myself. We're going to, and as a staff, we read his book and it was great. Dang it. Like it's great. Like, shoot, I couldn't find anything wrong with it. And a friend of mine, who he called me up and he said, hey, I want to go through a book with my staff. Do you have any recommendations? And I was like, this is actually a pretty great book. And he was like, yeah, I'm a little mad at that guy. And I was like, oh, good, thank God. And he's like, yeah, he got there first. Like, it's not fair. And this sort of envy, right? I say that, and hopefully you hear what I'm saying, right? This like, Jeff, come on. But we can't help. There's like certain things that like we want, and somebody else gets there, and we're like, shoot, that little seed of envy. But the truth is, it can get worse than that. And James talks about an envy there that's like, I mean, some of that's sort of benign, you realize it, and you chuckle, but if you're not careful, it becomes bitter envy. There's a sort of hostility that it breeds. Where I want that and I don't want you to have it. That's the sort of thing that you're like, you're kind of happy when you see somebody else lose. And that sort of feeling, right? James is like cutting open our hearts here and going like, there's surgery that needs to be done in this area. But the more we live in that comparative space, the more we get pulled down. The self-obsession or the bitter envy. And the fruit of it, we know. It's chaotic. We live in this world that is deeply anxious. Why? This constant comparison. Constant evaluation. Constant self-obsession. And to create a space like this, it requires us doing this kind of work, not pretending that these things aren't there, but instead shifting our gaze, turning from the things of this world, putting our eyes on a heavenly kingdom and the invitation that's there. What happens when we shift our gaze from what's below to what's above? I was reading this great book. It's called, Community Code? The Community Code. I think that's right. And somebody Google it real quick for me. And in this, it's talking about how we create what he would describe as like safe spaces. How do we create this place where everybody is thriving? I mean, he made an interesting statement there where he's like, one malcontent person in a group will drop that group's effectiveness by 40%, right? The energy of that group, the cohesiveness, the safety. And so in this, they did this study, and they gave these people 20 pieces of uncooked spaghetti, 1 yard of transparent tape, 1 yard of string, and 1 standard-sized marshmallow. And they said, what you got to do as a group is build a structure where that marshmallow is held at the top, and we're going to measure how high that marshmallow will be. And that's, you know, those are the winners. And so they did this with a number of different groups. Business school students, like people doing MBAs, 10 inches. Lawyers, 15 inches. CEOs, 22 inches. But what's so brilliant is guess who had the highest? Kindergartners. 26 inches. 26 inches, the kindergartners. They just dominated it, right? Wasn't even close. Culture code. Thank you. Not community code. Culture code. And in this, he talks about this idea of status management. And it says for the kids that they're figuring out where, or the, for the adults, they're figuring out where they fit into the larger picture. Who is in charge? Is it okay to criticize someone's idea? What are the rules here? Their interactions appear smooth, but their underlying behavior is riddled with inefficiency, hesitation, and subtle competition. Instead of focusing on the task, they're navigating their uncertainty about one another. They spend so much time managing status that they fail to grasp the essence of the problem. The marshmallow is relatively heavy, and the spaghetti is hard to secure. As a result, their first efforts often collapse, and then they run out of time. Kindergartners, what's their strategy? That they try a bunch of stuff together. They just dive in, right? Without criticism, without evaluation, without who's the important one, who's the one giving the orders. They just dive in, 26 inches statue, and they dominate it. And it says they, kindergartners, are tapping into a simple and powerful method in which a group of ordinary people can create a performance far beyond the sum of their parts. I thought, what a great definition of church, or at least the potentiality here. That we are this simple, ordinary group of people that are able to perform something far beyond our parts. But in so many ways, we need to remember how to become children. Mark 9, 33 through 37, this about the disciples, it said, they came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, this is Jesus, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the way?" But they were silent because on the way they had been arguing with one another about who was the greatest. Sitting down, he called the 12 and said to them, "If anyone wants to be the first, he must be last and servant of all." He took a child, had him stand among them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one little child such as this in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but him who sent me." I was thinking we ought to like just bring the kids back in for a second. This is what Jesus would do and be like, "You want to know how to behave? Just behave like them." And in some ways, this is like the invitation of this when we look above versus look below. What does that mean? We're almost in a way stopping our adult behavior and just behaving like kids, like a child looking up to his father. That there's a humility that comes with that. We become aware of our dependence. We stop trying to manage and control these things and just sort of accept the help we so desperately need. My mom used to always tell me as a kid that when we had like arguments and fights with the neighbor kids, she stayed out of them. Why? Because we'd get over it like 30 minutes later, but the parents would stay mad at each other forever, right? If my kid's offended, like now I've got a problem with you, and these parents would be like, "Well, I'm not over that last thing," and the kids are all out playing together. I read this quote that says, "Children can go from fighting 1 minute to asking if the other wants to come over and play the next." And that kind of resilience, that sort of grace, right? So often we're holding on to grudges or judging each other, right? And you see this like invitation and this childlike faith is to come back into that place of trust, come back into that place of security, to stop managing and controlling and instead to just forgive and move on. We have a hard time doing that. And I think that it's because we've been hurt. When I was thinking about that like shtick of mine to be sort of the low key, low expectation guy, I remember a time when I was in fourth grade, I had a teacher who said she requested me to be in her class. But she did it because she had my older sister in her class and she was like, "Oh, Carolyn." She's like, "I want the next one. I want Jeff." And then told me by the end of that year, "You're nothing like your older sister." But I was crushed by that. I felt like such a disappointment. And I think, oh my gosh, that's still in there, right? I'm still running off of that old wound. And how God is consistently speaking into that for me, healing that. But I came up with a strategy. I was never going to keep people's expectations up that high. I'm just going to start low, right? And then beat those expectations. That's a good strategy, don't you think? Except it's guarded, right? It's self-protective. In some ways, I'm managing something that I don't need to manage. And so I'm always worried about that. I'm always playing that game. The sort of gentleness of wisdom is somebody free where there's that spaciousness to it. I'm not worried about Jeff. I can just focus on whoever's right there in front of me. And instead of getting triggered and having all my emotions spill into it, I can just be patient with people. Be gracious. But I first have to receive that. And we only get that by raising our gaze. I love this quote from Chesterton. He says, "Grown-up people are not strong enough to exalt in monotony. But perhaps God is strong enough to exalt in monotony. It is possible that God says every morning, do it again to the sun, and every evening, do it again to the moon. It may not be automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike. It may be that God makes every daisy separately, but has never got tired of making them. It may be that he has the eternal appetite of infancy. For we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. And I think in that, right, this the healing that God is doing is returning us to this place, this redeemed place of self-forgetfulness, to become like a child who just can get lost in the beauty. The more we try to manage this, the more we try to limit the hard things in life, we tend to also reduce the joy, the pleasure, the happiness. But what happens when we turn our gaze to God? We see into the eyes of our Father. And I think, you know, for each one of us, the comparison game would be like me saying, which of my kids do I love the best? I'll tell you. Gabe. No, just kidding. Which of my kids do I love the best? Do I love Gabe or do I love Mia or do I love Lila? And I'm like, oh, Gabe, like my deep-hearted boy who like cares so much about purity of intention. So thoughtful. Or Mia, my brilliant little creative mind, that everything she does with precision and yet with this artistic brilliance. And then she has this really gentle thread in her. You should see her with her bird. It's just her darling little pet, this softness in her. Or Lila, who's just so wholehearted. Everything she does with her whole being. And she also notices the ones that are left out, the ones that are being overlooked, and cannot help but go alongside of them. This beautiful, compassionate love. Which of my kids do I love the most? What a silly question. And I think when we turn our gaze, that's who we see. Matthew 7, who among you, if his son asks him for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? If you then know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good things to those who ask him? In our Abolition of Man class this last week, I told this story, and it's just a goofy Jeff story, but I'm in Oxford. And we're walking by, we're going to go visit this graveyard, and the professor that's leading our time there says, you want to go to Lewis's tobacco shop? And I was like, yes, I do. And so we walk over, it's like rainy Oxford, and we walk into this old little tobacco shop. They've got this like these pipes from this Irish pipe maker, and they're Peterson, which are great, and he's got this one line that are called the Sherlock Holmes line, and I'm like, oh, I'm buying a pipe in Oxford. And then that night, Jerry and I, this professor, we like sat in Lewis's backyard at the kilns and smoked these pipes. And we talked about Chesterton's biography of Dickens. And some of you are probably thinking, boring. Or like, nerd alert. But I'm like sitting there going, oh my gosh, this is awesome, right? And I feel God just go, I know, right? This is so you, Jeff. Like, and this is the thing. Like, what is God impressed with about us? Nothing that we do or perform, right? I mean, I think sometimes he's proud. But I think God just delights in who you are. That little nerdy whatever that is in you. Like, God sees us and knows us better than we know ourselves. And I think sometimes God has to work really hard to get us to see it. That we're so stuck in this game that it takes a lot to get us out of that. David Benner says, the self that begins the spiritual journey is the self of our own creation. The self we thought ourselves to be. This is the self that dies on the journey. The self that arrives is the self that was loved into existence by divine love. This is the person we were destined from eternity to become. The I that is hidden in the I am. That's the tree. That's the invitation. That's the flourishing. James runs down this beautiful list of descriptives. What does a tree look like when it's flourishing? What do we look like when we're flourishing? That kind of wisdom is pure, not contaminated by sin, just free of all the compromise. It's peace-loving. Not peacemaking, or not peace like keeping, but peacemaking. This guy next door was working, they're tearing down some trees, and he came over and he's like, "Do you have some tweezers?" And he had this big old splinter in his finger, right? And you're like, you get that splinter in there, you can't work, right? He's so in pain, he finally pulls that splinter out, and there's blood, and he's like, ah, right? Peace. To get that thing out. Wisdom from above is gentle, which has this posture of meekness, laying down our strength. It's compliant. It's reasonable. It's open to having its mind changed. It's unwavering, wholehearted, without pretense, without pretending, without posturing, without trying to be something that it's not. This leadership guy that I like, Edwin Friedman says, would describe this as self-differentiated. It just knows who it is. And you know who you are and you know who you're not. He would say it's the single most important piece of leadership. To know who you are and to know who you are, you're not. To not be living in this place of trying to find your identity based on what everybody else sees, but to simply rest in that love. This becomes this place of strength. When we talk about our church being a safe place to heal and a brave space to grow, we have to be doing this work. Otherwise, we're going to constantly be judging each other, comparing, looking down at others, or over-exaggerating other people's gifts and responding in envy. That we're as vulnerable to that as anybody. But the gift that we have is to turn our gaze to our Maker, the one who really knows us. I was telling this story of this little goofy pipe story to my spiritual director, and she said, "Jeff, what did that do for you to notice that part of God? Would it change your understanding of Him?" And I was thinking, oh, I think in the end, I just felt a deeper trust. Because I think God sometimes leads us through really hard things. And I don't know about you, but I've had moments where life has been so hard and I've looked at God and thought, do you know what you're doing here? Like, are you sure this is the right call? And like, this is this loving God, and you're going, okay, that didn't seem very loving. I think God is constantly saying to us in that place, trust me. I think when we have these windows into like how He sees us, those become critical moments of joy that we hold to at the times where we don't quite understand. There's this lovely story in the Chronicles of Narnia where this boy has come to Narnia looking for this cure for his mom's cancer. And he finally meets the lion and he's staring down. And what he sees is the claws of the lion. And he feels this sort of resistance in himself. And he's like, I'm just going to ask. And he's like raising his gaze. And he's like, will you cure my mom? And as he raises his eyes, he sees the eyes of the lion. And what he sees is the lion's eyes filled with tears, so big that the boy realizes the lion cares more about his mom than he does. And this invitation to raise our gaze, this is part of why we come to church. When we worship, we lift our eyes. Some of us have broken distrust in our hearts, and God knows and He sees that. He responds with such compassion and grace, but invites us to lift our eyes to His eyes, to meet His eyes and to see that love, to find ourselves in that love. Who He sees us to be, what it looks like for you to flourish. When we plant our roots there, when we sink our roots into that stream, we're like a tree planted beside flowing streams that bear its fruit in its season. Its leaf does not wither. Whatever you do will prosper. Some questions, and then we're going to take just a moment to worship together with one last song. But here's the questions. And I'm going to switch the order of 2 and 3. Number one, what is your personal definition of flourishing? How do you measure it in your own life? And think about that. I mean, that's like a question to respond to honestly. How do I really view that? What am I comparing myself to? What is it that my like little strategy or shtick that I play? Number two, which says 3 up there, how are you seeking to find value in ways that create envy or anxiety in your heart? Right? To see where is that leading you? What is it causing in you? What is the unhealth? What are the ways that that's contaminating the fruit? Where do you see envy creep in, or ambition, selfishness? Number three, where has your trust been broken? And where does your heart need to mend? And this is what God is doing, I think, simultaneously to all of us. Shaping us, showing us who we truly are, healing us, mending us. And with that, using that as our strength, that becomes your authority, that redeemed heart is something even more beautiful. This brokenness that has become deeply beautiful in the redemption. I said, going deeper this week, spend some time in a posture of surrender. Allow God to speak into your wounds. Allow God to show you who He sees you to be. Amen.